No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to Skype in a question or call in at 888-627-6008. Marilia is not with me tonight. She's in Amsterdam. I hope she's having fun. I think she's working, but she's in Amsterdam and won't be back till tomorrow. So you'll see her again. We'll have her on again next week. But today we have a special guest, and that is former Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia. Mr. Moran served in politics for 35 years. He was a mayor of Alexandria for many years, and he spent 24 years representing Virginia's 8th congressional district. And we're really, really proud to have him on the show today. Welcome, Congressman. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask you the you know, about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Since you spent so many years in Congress, what do you think today about the divisiveness, Congressman? Is that something that's drastically different from when you were there? And is there anything we can do about it? It seems like we're no longer interested in promoting the public interest. We're just interested in which side wins. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was elected in 1990 when Newt Gingrich was elected, along with a vast number of Republicans in 1994. It ushered in more than a Republican majority. It ushered in a different mindset. He had taught all the Republican candidates not to treat Democrats as colleagues, but as enemies. He fashioned it almost as though there was a war, and he would use terms like, we need to go to battle with them. They're evil, they're wrong, they're bad for the country, they're un-American. You know, everything you can think of to demean and disparage Democrats. And that set up an intentional conflict. He eliminated the retreat that freshman, newly elected Democrats and Republicans would go to at the Harvard Kennedy School. It would give us a chance to get to know each other. We would have other opportunities to, we would travel up to Nema Colon, for example, or Hershey Park, or places that were not particularly expensive, but we'd get time to get to know each other, and the spouses would get to know each other, because we had far more in common than we had in disagreement, at that time, at least. We had a gentleman, a nice congressman from Arkansas, who ran the members' gym. It didn't take much, but you know, it was an opportunity in the gym that we could work out together. We could share ideas in a friendly format. Newt got rid of him because he was too moderate. I remember, being told a story, and I probably shouldn't use Tom's name, but I will. Tom Davis was something of a moderate. He believed, certainly, even though he was chair of the Republican campaign committee that ushered in that enormous windfall of Republicans, but he did believe in getting legislation done. Of course, I got to know him well because we served in adjoining districts, and we were really compulsive about working our constituency of whatever political persuasion they were. Well, at one point, Tom chaired the Government Reform Committee, that where the D.C. subcommittee was under it. One of the toughest issues was postal reform, because the Postal Service had been loaded down by this impossible indebtedness for future pensions that no corporation, certainly no public entity, had to bear. But I think it was designed to make sure that they were always broke, and that ultimately the American people, not understanding the why they were in debt, that they would eventually get rid of it and turn it over to the private sector. So I think it was a ruse to accomplish that privatization. He had sat down with the Postal Workers Union, the Letter Carriers Union, as well as FedEx and USPS and the other, not US, but UPS, and the other letter carriers, and he had worked out an agreement. And so he was going to resolve that issue, which had stewed for decades, and he couldn't get it to the floor. So he went to Tom DeLay, who was the whip, a guy from Texas, and he asked, "What's the matter here? I've worked this out. This is important legislation. We can get rid of this very controversial item." And Tom said, "We're not going to do that." And the reason is that Republicans were raising an enormous amount of money on that issue. And similarly, Democrats were raising money from the Postal Workers Union. No. And if you resolve it, then that money isn't going to be raised. And besides, it's a message issue. And to get rid of it, it dulls the message and reduces the reasons for conflict. He didn't get into all that explanation, but that was clearly what he was conveying. And so it never got fixed. I think that exposed a good deal of what this is about. It's about raising money. It's about creating conflicts. It's about perpetuating these echo chambers of ideology, where all you hear is something that reinforces your beliefs that whatever they may be. And it's on the left and the right, but it started with the right. And I think it's just gotten worse. And of course, this is eventually you create two warring camps ideologically in this country. And Trump was a very savvy, skillful in going after the Republican camp. I mean, it's not a traditional Republican camp. In fact, I mentioned Tom Davis. When he gives a speech, he generally explains that the Republicans have moved from the country club to the country. If you find an area that has a university and a well-educated population and a metro station, they're blue, they're Democratic. You find a place that doesn't have as good a public education system, that doesn't have a strong an economy, that doesn't have Starbucks and doesn't have public transit, they're invariably going to be Republican. And it's two warring camps now, and it serves a lot of people's best interest, but it doesn't serve the American interest.
Well, you know, first of all, I think you invoked the name of Tom Davis, who you know well. As a Republican from Virginia, was also a friend of the District of Columbia. I don't think he put together the DC Voting Rights Act. I don't think that we have a friend like that anymore on the Republican side of things, and it dismays me greatly. But
I agree with you. We could have gotten statehood. He had an arrangement, right, where you would have given Republican seats to Utah, and Utah's right. population had grown significantly, and in return, D.C. would have gotten right. the seat. So it was a fair compromise. But again,
it was a fair compromise.
Yeah.
But you know what else? I'd like to ask you, Congressman, since you bring up money, I have always been of the position that the best thing you could do to reform Congress would be to make congressmen's terms 4 years instead of two, so they don't spend all their time trying to fundraise. What do you think of that idea? Do you think that's that would be a positive step? I don't think it's going to happen, but
no.
These
it's
guys.
Michael, it's not going to happen. And unfortunately, the troubling reality is there are so many people now involved in that fundraising. They don't really yes. want it to get fixed.
Right.
And you look at senators. The senators have six-year terms, but gosh, they're fundraising every year. They're always fundraising.
Yeah, they're always fundraising. And let me ask you, you were very much involved in the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, the
yes.
Metro to Dulles, the widening of Route 1 to Fort Belvoir, and lots of construction projects on local roads and bridges. How important is it to America to have a national infrastructure built?
Oh, you need to. We have fallen far behind China. We're behind a number of other European nations in terms of our infrastructure. When you think about it, from the very beginning of this country, if you were on water, you had a chance to generate an economy and have a economically viable
right.
community. And then if you were on a rail line, same thing. And then when Eisenhower built the interstate highway system, that enabled so many communities to become big cities. You've got to be able to commute. And now if you have an airport, you're going to be a big city. But if you don't have an airport, people aren't going to invest a substantial amount of capital. So you have to have an infrastructure. And we had to fix that bottleneck on the Wilson Bridge. I'll tell you a little funny story if you want.
Please.
About the Wilson Bridge. So I worked hard on it because it was in my congressional district, of course. And Tom Davis was very helpful, and he was the chair of the Republican Campaign Committee, so he got votes. Frank Wolf was the chair of the Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee, so he helped me get votes. And John Warner helped. John chaired the Surface Transportation Committee. I remember at a fundraiser that John Warner was actually doing for Mark Warner, if you can believe it. If you remember when Mark first ran against John,
yes,
he had these signs all over the state. He had these signs all over the state saying "Mark, not John." Quoting the Bible or whatever. So the New Testament. So, but now John became much more enlightened. I don't know whether it was Elizabeth Taylor's influence or I think it was just John being John. The country has turned more conservative. John stayed the way he was, and he was a good guy. So. But at that fundraiser, he says, and Jim Moran was responsible for the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. And I answered, I said, look, Senator, I'd love to take credit, but the fact that you were chair of the Surface Transportation Committee in the Senate was what got it done. He said, well, now that you mention it, yeah, that's probably true. He said something like, everybody give me an applause. It was funny, but the frustrating thing was that it took so long to build, Michael, that Tim Kaine was then the senator, not John, Bob Ehrlich, who voted against the money for the Wilson Bridge. I mean, Bob's now something of a friend now, so I'm not critical of him. It's kind of funny, though. He voted against it, and he was the governor of
Maryland.
And Tony Williams, I believe, was the one that pushed in D.C., and he was out of office. So that when they finally opened the bridge, they had the heads of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia ride in these Model T cars across the bridge for the first time. None of them had been involved. And the and the irony is that Bob Ehrlich voted against it.
Yeah.
None
yeah.
of the people that got the money and got any of the credit. It was all new people who weren't involved in getting the money, riding these Model Ts. And where was Tom, Frank, and myself? We were up in the peanut gallery. We didn't even get recognized.
Well, let me tell you.
These guys, you know, thanks a lot, guys. And, well, you know, it is what it is. It's it was a lot of fun. Anyways, well,
I want to thank you. I want to thank you, Congressman, because I used to, when I was dating my wife many, many years ago, she lived on the other,
that?
You know, no, she was living on the other side of the Wilson Bridge, and you could come to the Wilson Bridge. I mean, it was the most amazing thing. You could be at the Wilson Bridge on a Wednesday night at midnight, and it would be bumper to bumper. Like, there was no logic to, you know, to why the bridge was always crowded. But
the southern part of Old Town opposed it viciously because they didn't want, you know, all the traffic. But the reality is they were getting all the pollution from the automobiles idling in line. They were getting covered with pollution. And yet, really, they were kind of small-minded when you think about it, and opposing the bridge. The money that was lost and people sitting there waiting to get into work was ridiculous. But it's a good example of why we need infrastructure. I'm glad you mentioned it, Michael. Tell us about how you were courting your wife and all.
I lied to her, Congressman. She thought I had money, and before she realized I was broke, we had three kids, and there was nothing she could do.
She was stuck.
But you know what? I got to talk to you about this. I hate labels, but, you know, you've been called a progressive by many people, and we've just seen this thing in San Francisco where the school board, three members, progressive members of the school board, were, you know, defeated in a special election, and lots of those political pundits that are out there are calling it a wake-up call for progressives. Do you think it's a wake-up call for – are we having a fight in the Democratic Party, a split between what you might call mainstream liberals, guys like me, and progressives? Is that happening for us, you think?
Those members of the school board were not progressive in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, radical. Progressive comes from a determination to achieve progress. They weren't achieving progress. They were embarrassing the liberals that elected them. Imagine changing the names of 42 schools because in Washington's case, he did have slaves, but he was the father of the country. And when you read biographies about him, you know, he was pretty important guy and had a lot more redeeming qualities. And you know, there's no excuse for having slaves, but you have to look at things in context and realize people aren't perfect. To remove Lincoln, to remove Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin.
Yeah.
I mean, this was just stupid. Everybody has faults. Everybody is trying to, some people aren't trying to do better, but most people are. And those were the presidents who founded our country and enabled these folks to have a democracy where they could get elected. So that a lot of them, these presidents, they wanted to change the name because they weren't sufficiently committed to progressive values. Well, what the hell is that? So they did that. Then they decided, let's take the most successful school where people are that is attracting people who otherwise would invariably be going to private school. They're sending the kids to public school. They're contributing to the public school system in a major way, and it's a school that we take great pride in. They wanted to fill it all with a lottery. All those families are going to simply leave the public school system because their children needed to be challenged, and so they're going to put them in the private school system. But they did all kinds of things. There was no face-to-face education for two straight years. So you've got 2 years where the kids, and the problem with that, and actually it's not just San Francisco, is that it's fine if you've got two parents that are able to spend time with their child, who read, who have books, who read to their child, and children who are computer savvy, that's fine. They'll catch up. But that's not the case for a whole lot of students. And D.C. is an example. There's an awful lot of students. Those kids are never going to catch up.
Yes.
And so they're 2 years behind, and they may be 2 years behind in terms of being economically competitive throughout their adult lives. It was wrong. And, I do consider myself progressive, and I can point to more progressive initiatives I took as mayor and things, ways I voted in the Congress, if anybody wants to challenge me. But frankly, the teachers were the first to get vaccinated, and in some school districts, the last to teach the children. And I do think there had to be a way with the children who weren't computer savvy, who didn't have those resources at home, to enable them to get some teaching. It really troubles me that there was very little effort made, and I think there's going to be a reckoning. And it's not just a political reckoning, but there's, unfortunately, the children are going to pay the real price. But I think the Democratic Party is going to pay a price, and similarly to the way that Terry McAuliffe lost to Glenn Youngkin. Terry was so much more qualified to be governor, and he's a progressive, but he lost because of the impression that had been given that the Democratic Party, frankly, was not progressive enough. If you want to define progressive as pushing for progress in our priorities, which is better life, particularly for our children. But I'm going on too long on this issue.
No, you're not.
And it's one that really troubles me.
Me too. And my wife is a Virginia school teacher. She's the librarian at Annandale High School in Fairfax County. And she feels the same way. And when McAuliffe, by the way, McAuliffe used to have the office across the hall from mine at the DNC. I worked with him, and I also worked with Mark Warner. We were all on staff. We were youngsters, you know. They didn't pay us much, and we worked hard, but we were all committed. And you're right, he was much more qualified for the office and had been governor. And my recollection is that he was a well-liked governor when he was governor.
Yes, he was well-liked because he was very good at being a governor.
Yeah, when he made that statement, I forget exactly what the statement was about. It's the responsibility of teachers to develop the curriculum and not parents. My wife stood up at the dinner table and applauded. She said, that's exactly right. But it seemed, unfortunately, to be part of his undoing. So let me ask you two questions. One, I don't mean to cast aspersions on the state of Virginia, but I think a one-time term limit for governors, don't you think that's extreme? That a governor can only, you were in Congress for 24 years, so there's a steep learning curve. You know, you were a mayor, you were don't really get it right off the bat. It takes a while. So isn't it crazy to just have a one term term limit for governors?
I I don't know that it's crazy, but I sure think we'd be better served, because right now we've got a Republican governor, so
yeah.
You know, the,
right. Now it serves us well. But
the reality is that most states have repeating terms, and I think that makes sense. The problem, Michael, is that it's not going to be fixed, because the legislature would have to fix it.
Yeah.
And it's the legislature, many of whom want to be governor. So not gonna,
yeah.
It gives them more chance to be governor if, you know, it's a one-term governorship.
Yeah.
So they're not going to fix it.
Well, and that was my experience at the DNC. I was in fundraising, and I was in fundraising compliance, and there were big loopholes left in FEC requirements and other things, because it was the politicians that put together what those requirements should be. Sure. So they left plenty of of wiggle room, which is the province of most elected officials. But is Virginia a bellwether? You know, Virginia is an important state. And by the way, I think it's so appropriate that we should have a member, a former member of Congress from the state that produced more presidents than any other state on President's Day weekend. But is it a bellwether? Is Virginia, do the Democrats have to take heed of what happened to McAuliffe and you know, mend their wicked ways?
It is going to be a bellwether, I fear. I think the Democrats are going to lose about 50 seats in November, and the Democrats may lose the Senate as well. Mm. And unless we're careful, we're going to lose the presidency too.
Yeah. What do you think about former President Trump's chances? I don't know about his chances in the general election, but do you think there's a Republican out there that can beat him in the primary? Is there a Republican? It's a shame, because I think there's some decent Republicans, former governor of Ohio, former governor of Maryland, or current governor of Maryland, Hogan. Some of them are good.
They are good, and that's the very problem. Because they have integrity, and they won't endorse Trump's claim that the election was stolen from them, and that's why they can't win in a Republican primary. A Republican primary, as you very well know, draws the most activist members of the party, and they're Trumpists. They're passionately for Trump. I can't relate to Republicans today. It just doesn't, it's a party that is a daily embarrassment, but it is what it is, as they say. I was thinking today, listening to Hillary Clinton's speech that in New York before the state Democratic convention, that it's not inconceivable that you could have a matchup between her and Trump again. She may be the only one that can get a Democratic nomination, and Trump may be the only one who could get the Republican nomination. And this time, I think she would beat him. You heard of it first here.
Well, it's funny. You know, from your lips to God's ear, Congressman, there's that old adage, right, that we all go by in the Democratic Party, that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. They fall in line behind whatever candidate they have. And, you know, I've been an official in one sense or another at the last 13 Democratic conventions. And I can tell you that they were, before Milwaukee, the last convention in Philadelphia, there were people at the convention yelling, Bernie, 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 Bernie. Even when we had a nominee, there were people that weren't satisfied at that point, couldn't get, you know, that's part of our problem, right? The great Witt from Oklahoma said, I belong to no organized political movement. I'm a Democrat. And Will Rogers. And that's still true today, is it not? We end up sometimes being our own worst enemy. So do you think that, you're the first person I've heard say that you think she can get the nomination, but and you think she could win if that happens, because people didn't turn out for her last time and realize what a mistake it was? Do you think that's, or do you think there's enough?
I don't think they'd be as tolerant of Russian interference time around. I think Hillary would get a better campaign staff that would recognize that she needed to get out and see regular people and not charge $2,800 to be able to go to an event with her. I think she was poorly served by some of her campaign staff. I think she'd just do it better. And, you know, I frankly think she's the best we have, because I don't think Joe is going to run again.
Well, and there was a lot of rancor, you know, that there were many people on her staff that felt that the nomination was stolen from her from Barack Obama. You can remember back in those days that we all thought she had it in the bag, right? And then this guy, this freshman senator from Illinois, came with a brilliant strategist who knew that a lot of her support was weak. It wasn't strong.
I was one of those people. I think Barack Obama was a good president.
He was.
He served the country well. But I always felt badly that, because Hillary would have been great too. I did think that it would be a good thing for this country to have a black man as president, and he was clearly the one, and this was the time, and so she took a back seat to what we wanted to achieve for the long term betterment of the country. Then we supported her, and I don't think, you know, she was 8 years older. She frankly didn't appear as well, on the campaign trail. I hate to say that, but, you know, you have to be hard-nosed about politics, because politics is a hardball game. And I still think she's the most qualified.
Well, isn't it a strange thing? Don't you find it strange about politics that people have to like you? You know what I mean? Like, if you put Hillary Clinton's resume in front of you, if you were hiring for your law firm and you put Donald Trump's resume in front of you, it would be a no-brainer, right? That he was so much more well qualified for the office than this man was. But there's that thing that people have to like you. It's a personality thing.
Compare John Kerry's resume with George W.'s resume.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's the same, but people would much rather have a beer with George W. than John Kerry, who was kind of office.
Yeah, frankly. He was. Yes, he's very, very, I've met him on occasion, and he's very kind of, you know, people have that political thing like Bill Clinton, right? You want to have a beer with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, but, for sure.
And some Ken of them. Kennedy. Some of them don't. And, you know, when you bring up I was going to say, when you bring up the fact that Trump is still holding on to this myth of he won the election, you know, it's got to make you proud as a Democrat to remember Al Gore, who lost by a few hanging chads and stood up and accepted it.
He didn't lose. What happened was that the Republican operatives, many of them young down there, they were counting it, and they realized that Gore won. And so they called Jim Baker, and Baker called the Supreme Court. And I think it was Scalia that he talked to, and Scalia got the five Republicans together. And, you know, they overturned, they gave the election to Bush, that they knew that Gore had won it. That's why, there were some people within the camp, and Gore just felt for the betterment of the country that he would be this gentleman and he would defer to him. But he didn't lose that. It was the people who got to Baker to get to the Supreme Court. The reason they did was that they realized that that Gore had actually won that battle of the hanging chads. That there were communities that were almost all Jewish, and you had them voting for the guy that Pat Buchanan. Once they corrected that stuff, they realized, not by a lot, but Gore had won by, a small margin in Florida. And so he had won the election, and the Republicans weren't going to allow it. So.
Yep. And, but yeah.
What a different world it would have been. We wouldn't have gone into the Iraq War. We would have focused on protecting our environment. We would have taken the international lead addressing global warming. It would have been such a better world. But hell, it would have been a better world if we had elected George McGovern in 1972.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you voted for him, but I was one of the six people that voted for him.
Oh, I voted for him. Well,
I couldn't believe it because I was the first 18 vote. I know. And I got up that morning and I just couldn't believe that Richard Nixon had, because I was a college student and we thought Richard Nixon was horrible and we just couldn't believe that.
Well, he was, but us college students is what lost it. It was that Chicago convention. It scared people, and they didn't want the country run by radicals who were going to support that kind of disruption.
Yeah, absolutely. And, let me ask you another thing about Virginia politics. We just read the front page of the Metro section today had that Governor Youngkin, the new Republican governor of Virginia, is now going to be able to put a lot of people on panels that were generally seen as a perfunctory right of the government, the governor that was leaving, to appoint people to council. The Republicans have now stood against all these opponents because of this environmentalist coal lobbyist who was put up by the Republicans to be an environmental ahead of the environmental stuff in Virginia. I really can't even believe that you can nominate a person like that. But is this just petty politics, you think?
Yeah. Some of the people I don't know. The reality is, though, that these boards don't have a whole lot of influence. I mean, the Board of Education has some, but they did reappoint Tim Kaine's wife, and she's Ann Holt, and she's terrific. The other people they didn't appoint, I'm not sure how much the difference it makes, and the Water Control Board and they're not necessarily committees that are going to be decisive in terms of policy. So I wouldn't make quite as big a deal about it as the Post is. You need to write a column every day if you're covering Richmond, and that column needs to be controversial if anybody's going to read it. But it's only four boards, I think, and none of them are consequential.
And isn't that a big problem today in our politics, is that we have this 24-hour news cycle. We've got all this social media stuff. I don't care how crazy you are or what your position is on anything. You can find somebody on the internet that agrees with you, regardless of how. Isn't that a major problem for us? In you know, because people really don't. Somebody like you, Congressman, pays attention to politics. You're part of the attentive public. But there's not, you know, that makes up about 10% of the public. The other 90% really doesn't, they pay attention to the sound bite and, you know, and gas prices and food prices. They really don't pay much attention to other stuff. And this is, right, this is just fertile ground for all this division, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, I don't think that the people in our that are going through our schools generally even understand how our government works. I don't think they can answer simple questions. How many justices are on the Supreme Court? I don't think the majority of Americans the high school students can answer that question. I don't think they know how the Electoral College works. I don't think we do a very good job of teaching civics. I really think that a majority of our country is clueless, and that's why democracy is in danger, even in the United States.
Well, you know, I got to say that it was a Virginia president, a guy named Thomas Jefferson, who was worried about that, right? When they founded the country, he was worried about uneducated people having the right to vote and people that didn't, you know, they thought that if you didn't own land, you didn't have a stake in things. So you shouldn't be allowed to vote. And of course, that covers the whole spectrum. I mean, you can talk about Thomas Jefferson. You can also talk about Karl Marx. They all, you know, they all said this was a weakness of our democracy. And I hate to see this all coming true. Well, let me ask you: do you miss being in Congress, Congressman?
Some days I do. What's going on now makes me miss it. I'd be chairman of Defense Appropriations now, and so I'd be, playing a role that made a difference in terms of our policy. I would have weighed in strongly as I could against that kind of immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think it was poorly handled. I think it made our country look bad, and it wasn't fair to the people who had worked for us and with us in Afghanistan. I'd like to have been able to weigh in on what's going on in Ukraine right now. I think some of our defense budget is misallocated, and I don't think we put enough into technology, and I think we put too much into legacy systems. But you know, I made a decision. I was frustrated. I felt that, the ability of individual members of Congress had diminished to be able to make a real difference. And I had spent most of my adult life in politics. I felt that my kids had sacrificed enough, and it was time to get the money, you know, and give them, I'd help them have a little better life.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Let me ask you one last thing. Since you're an outspoken opponent of the Iraq war, what about Ukraine? You know, the president tells us that Vladimir Putin is about to invade Ukraine, which we have every reason to believe, given the buildup of troops. What do you think our response should be or can be? What kind of response can we have if they move into Ukraine?
Well, I'll say some things, and I'll try to add a little light on it that might not have been discussed in reading the newspapers or watching television. First of all, Vladimir Putin is a bad guy. KGB agent. KGB agent. He gained power by blowing up a multifamily apartment complex He did it, and then blamed the Uyghurs so that, and then Yeltsin turned over the government to him because people felt that he was going to be a strong leader. He has no moral character. He's the wealthiest man in the world. He's taken tens of billions of dollars. He's never been in private business, and here he's the wealthiest man in the world. He's got enormous wealth all over the world, and he's just taken it from the country, mostly in the sale of oil. He gets a cut of all the big deals, and all the big transactions have to get his approval. So he's just a really rotten guy. But with regard to Ukraine, when they took over Crimea, very little pushback occurred from people living in Crimea. They consider themselves Russians. And I'm wondering how many people who live in Donbass and Donetsk, at those two urban parts of eastern Ukraine, how many of them would actually rather be part of Russia? If there was a plebiscite, now there was a plebiscite in Crimea, and that plebiscite overwhelmingly voted to be returned to Russia. I don't think it was a free and fair election, though. The military was there around the polling station. So my guess is the Russians made sure of the result. But I'm not sure how different the result would have been if they hadn't. Just like Putin would be reelected right now. If he was to have a free and fair election in Russia, people would vote for Vladimir Putin because that's their mindset. They think he's a strong leader. And, of course, they've been, they don't get access, really, to objective news reporting. It's all state-controlled. But it's possible that there are parts of eastern Ukraine that would rather be part of Russia. They speak Russian. Their culture is Russian. And when Ukraine was turned over, was pulled out of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of discussion whether all of eastern Ukraine should be part of Ukraine or should it be part of Russia. I wish there could be a free and fair election of plebiscite. Now, Ukraine's not going to allow that because there are a lot of resources. And, when the South wanted to secede, we wouldn't allow it because that was more justified because it wasn't just the resources that the South had. We believed that human beings shouldn't be enslaved. And so I think it was a virtuous war that the Union fought to keep our country united. But it may be a little different in Ukraine. I wonder if it's possible to, for example, make a compromise that there would be a plebiscite that would be internationally monitored to see whether these communities in eastern Ukraine want to be part of Russia. And if they did vote in a fair election to be part of Russia, then Russia could acquire them. I mean, we wouldn't like to see that, but if the majority of people living there democratically would rather be in Russia, then, that they should be, that seems to me they should be allowed if that's what they want, to live under a totalitarian dictatorship. If we believe in democracy, I think we would have to let them go. So that's the only thing I'd throw out there. If it's just about areas that, are leaning in that direction, it's maybe is a way to avoid this. Otherwise, I do think we're going to go to war. And the problems with war is that the vast majority of the people killed in a war are innocent civilians.
Yeah. And do you think we can do anything militarily? Isn't this inside their sphere of influence, like Cuba was for us?
Well, we can provide logistics. We can provide armaments. I don't think we'll go to war. I do think we will have very severe sanctions, but I'm not sure Putin cares that much. Yeah. I mean, he may be that selfish. He knows that he's got, tens of billions of dollars all over the world. So I'm not sure that it would upset him that much if the Russian people suffered in the way that we could make them suffer by cutting off trade. We did it to Iran, and Iran, it really hasn't weakened Iran that much. So I don't know. I'm afraid, if he does attack Ukraine, which he may very well, I don't think the sanctions are going to deter him, and he may just go right to the capital of Kyiv and kill a whole lot of people. And I don't think that NATO or the United States is going to get involved in that fight. That's the problem.
Well, on that note, I'm going to let you go, Congressman. I appreciate so much that you have taken this time to be with us tonight. I think we've had a great conversation. I hope maybe in the future sometime you come back where we could talk about hopefully your prediction of 50 congressmen doesn't come true, but maybe your prediction of Hillary will come true.
We'll see.
We'll see. And will you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when your assistant called, I think this was months. It was back in October, late October, maybe. Yeah. And she asked just out of the blue, "Who do you think is going to win the Super Bowl?" And I hadn't really given any thought that the Rams, I think, had just lost four games in a row or something, and so the chances were like 500-1 that they'd win the Super Bowl. And I blurted out the Los Angeles Rams, and she actually remembered that. So it's no credit to me, but
let's see what happens.
If I'm 2-2, I'll feel pretty proud of myself.
Soothsayer powers continue to go on. And do me one last favor.
Yes, sir.
I had a friend who was a fundraiser for your brother, Brian, who I've met. So please tell him I said hello. The first time I met him, there's such a strong family resemblance. I'll let you guys fight it out of who's the more handsome of the two of you, but he was a great guy.
He's a lot younger, and he'll be a lot more successful. I talk to Brian nearly every day.
Please do, because my friend Walter raised money for him, and we went to a meeting.
Nice.
And we were very, very taken by him. Okay, thank you, Congressman.
Terrific.
Continue
success.
A
pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Good bye. Luck. Thank Bye-bye. You. Bye. We're going to end. We're ending the show just a couple minutes early today with the Congressman, so that I can make an announcement. We've been off the air. Really, we've had repeats the last 2 weeks, and part of the reason for that was my brother Paul, who was a decorated veteran. He was a major in the United States Air Force, flew F-111s, and then went on to become the president of one of the best community colleges in America, Zane State College in Zanesville, Ohio, where he increased enrollment by 70% and brought in a lot of new programs and really affected the lives of thousands and thousands hundreds and hundreds of students in Appalachia. His legacy still goes on. Unfortunately, he was flying his private plane, and the plane crashed, and he was killed in the crash. So I love this man so much. I could go on about him for hours. I was orphaned as a teenager. He and my older sister helped raise me, and he was just an amazing person. He loved America, he loved his family, and he will be sorely missed by all of us. So tonight, instead of dedicating a song to our guest, I'm going to dedicate this to Dr. Paul R. Brown, a retired major who was many things, but most of all to me, was the best big brother in the history of the world. I love you, Paul. I will miss you. Here's the Steve Miller Band with a tribute to my brother. We'll see you next week. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.